No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Unfortunately, Marilia can't be with us tonight. She had something come up, and so it's just me, but I'm excited because I have Senator Bob Kerry with us tonight, and I'm just so excited. And for those of you who may not know, Senator Kerry has done it all. He was the governor of Nebraska. He was a United States Senator, a Navy SEAL. He is a Congressional Medal of Honor recipient, and we're so excited to have him on the show. Welcome, Senator. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Michael. Nice to hear your voice.
Well, you know, let me first start out by doing what I was trained to do. I'm from a military family. My brother was an F-111 pilot, and my dad was a combat veteran. And so let me start by thanking you for your service, sir, because we all understand that the liberties that we enjoy were paid for by brave men and women like you. So thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
And let's start I want to start at the beginning. You were a pharmacy student. You're an entrepreneur that started helped develop a chain of restaurants and health clubs. You had 1,000 employees at one time. What led you from there to politics?
Oh, you know, you probably know this, but when you go in business, I got out of service officially in 69. I came back to Nebraska and started a business with my brother-in-law in 72. And you're constantly, when you're in business, having to get permits, city, county, state. And so I had a pretty direct relationship with people in politics. And among the things that I saw from time to time is, you know, they understandably get afraid when faced with a choice that they didn't want to have to make. And then there weren't that many Democratic businessmen in Nebraska, and the governor's race opened up in 1982, and the leading candidates for the Democratic nomination came by and talked to me. I presume they wanted my financial support. I wasn't active. Nobody really knew who I was. I had been a Republican until 78. They all decided not to run. So I was skiing with my brother-in-law, my business partner, and out in Jacksonville, Wyoming. And told him on the ski slopes, I said, I'm going to go back to Nebraska and file for governor. And I think it really began with me I thought I would enjoy it, and I thought I'd be good at it. And I thought, and still do, that public service is, it's extremely important and very satisfying. Some of my best friends I met in campaigns or working in the government one way, shape, or form. So it's been a very, very rewarding experience. I've not been disappointed at all on that decision to run for governor in 1982.
Well, that's good to hear, because you certainly were successful at it, and I'm glad to know you enjoyed it. And I certainly have always felt that. You know, some of the best people. The first thing that somebody told me at the DNC, when I started working at the DNC, was don't forget that the cream always rises to the top, but so does the scum. And I found out that over the years, some of the absolute best people that I've ever met in my life are in politics. But unfortunately, some of the worst people are there, too. On that note, let me ask you, as a governor, you're a member of the Democratic Governors Association. I worked with the DGA when I was at the DNC. I think Governor Brown was the head of the DGA in those days. And I've really been dismayed as a Democrat recently over the fact that the DGA has put money into campaigns of campaign deniers, Trumpers, who they put money into their primary campaigns, helping them win because they thought they would be easier to beat in a general election. Yep. Do you find that as cynical as I find it? I find it really cynical.
Yes, I do. I mean, I understand what they're doing, and on a practical basis, I understand why they're doing it. But there's no question that it increases people's cynicism about politics, which is unfortunate. And it's hard to get it back. I mean, in today's era of you know, the way we communicate with one another, you know, one little story like that. We've been following the terrible stories that have been coming out about Paul Pelosi, Anthony's husband. There's a non-existent newspaper called the Santa Monica Observer, and they put out this horrible story about, and none of it was true. They don't care if it's true, but Elon Musk posted.
Right.
He later pulled it down, but that's the problem today, is that these stories go viral in a hurry, and I'm raising it because you're not the first person that asked me about that. That would, you know, don't you think that's terrible? My answer is yes, I do. I understand why it's done, but it just undercuts the primary thing that particularly Democrats are trying to say, that it's government up by and for the people, and the people get to decide. We don't need to. We just don't need to do this, and so it's hopefully by the time the election comes around a week from Tuesday, that kind of thing has been forgotten, because there's no equivalence here. What the Republicans are doing is far, far worse, and denying the fact for the first time we've never had a president lose an election and then campaign across the country that the election was stolen. Because what that does is it causes a lot of good Americans to say, if their candidate loses, it was fraudulent, that their election was stolen. And among the most vivid memories I have in politics, the night of the 1982 gubernatorial election, I was running against an incumbent, Governor Thone, and he called me and conceded the election. It wasn't a big, I think it was a 1% margin or something like that. And I know that was a hard call for him to make. It was a difficult call for him to make. It was a brave call for him to make. And that's what we expect our elected representatives to do. So we're, I don't know what the numbers are, but, you know, a large fraction of Americans believe the lie that former President Trump has been telling them. And it really does concern me, and I think lots of other people as well, that it could become a pattern. We saw it in Arizona, the gubernatorial candidate out there, yes, I will absolutely say the election wasn't fraudulent so long as I win.
Right.
We can't let that virus spread. And it's because it's unquestionably dangerous to democracy.
You're absolutely right. And I've had to make that call. And you're absolutely right. It's a really hard call to make. But you have to do it, right? Those are the rules of the game. Yeah, this is really horrible. And now, did you ever fear for your safety or your family's safety when you were in the Senate? I mean, this is a new thing, isn't it? I've never feared for my safety. I have tags on my car that say U.S. Senator, and my colleague has considered taking them off because he's afraid. And this is a brand new thing. And you're right. It's horrible. It's all generated out of this misinformation. What do you think about Elon Musk taking over Twitter. Do you have any feelings about that? Do you think that's a obviously it seems that he's going to let Donald Trump back on, and you know, that's the speculation anyway. And what do you think about that? You think that's
well?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I was actually there when he passed the Communication Decency Act and created this loophole for these companies, so they're not held to the same standards that licensed radio, television, and newspapers are. And I think we got to close that loophole because it's, nothing against Elon Musk. He's been very successful with, creating, one of the great automobile companies, and I love what he's doing in the space. And, I don't quite understand why he wants to, but I don't have to understand. What concerns me about this is, and again, I can make a business case for it, but the first thing we read about after the transaction closed is how many people he's going to fire.
Right.
And I didn't ever actually watch The Apprentice, but I've seen the closing statement that Donald Trump at the time, not president, would make at the close of these things. He'd say, "You're fired." It's not funny to hear those two words. And maybe it makes the company better. I don't know, but we shouldn't be happy that a bunch of people that are the next couple of weeks are going to get fired because he wants to change the nature of the Twitter. Again, he owns it. He gets to make those decisions, but I don't think we should celebrate it. Indeed, it's one of the, it's coming up to the midterms. One of the things that the Democrats have really, I think, regathered themselves and making certain that we put the laws on the side of people who get up every morning and go to work. They ought to be able to not be. They shouldn't be afraid they're not going to have health insurance. You ask if I was afraid when I was governor. I get called upon a fair amount of time, particularly when I was governor, to go visit in households where somebody has suffered an amputation of a limb because I did in Vietnam. So they said, "Would you come and visit us?" My daughter and my son, either cancer or farm accident, typically. And, but I genuinely feel fear that in those moments when I knew they didn't have health insurance, when I knew they were going to have to rely on charity to pay the bills, and the reason I'm saying it quite that strongly is under law, I had a claim on their income, still do. I have a claim on your income to pay for my prosthetics.
Right.
So what the fear that I sometimes feel is for the future of the country when you get this great inequality of capacity of people to buy health insurance, buy child care in order to be able to give their kids a good education, be able to afford to go to college. These things are slipping away. And the general promise of trade and technology and immigration is going to be good for the middle class hasn't proven up. I really am worried about the United States when you if we arrive at a point where a large fraction of our people say it's not worth keeping your nose clean, not worth doing the right thing. It's why I think what President Trump is doing by denying the outcome of the election is so bad. It's not against the law, but it's against normative behavior. I was never afraid anybody was going to do anything violent to me while I was governor, but I was then and still am concerned about the future of the country when you have so many people who are working, doing the right thing, going to church on Sunday, saving their money, taking care of their parents, and they're still not making it.
Have we lost touch, Senator, have we lost touch with the American people? I often say that I was born a Democrat because I was an orphan who had my first full-time job at 14 and got my first decent paycheck when I lied about my age at 17 and became a Teamster. And so when I got old enough to vote, I felt that I already was a Democrat. They were the party of the working class. They were the party of the middle class. And have we lost touch? One thing that really bothers me is I don't understand how a man who never worked a day in his life and inherited great wealth and became a billionaire convinced working class people that he could feel their pain. I don't know how he did that. Did he do that because he's a Svengali, or did he do it because the Democrats have lost touch?
Well, it's a very good question. I don't think the Democrats have lost touch. It's easy, you know what it's like in public life. You can, from time to time, lose touch. I mean, to kind of turn the conversation slightly, there's an awful lot of working people when I was in the Senate or the governor, either one, they could be Teamsters, they could be liberal Democrats, and they'd say, you know, I'm paying a lot of taxes. What am I getting for it? Or, like me, they're trying to start a small business and they find themselves having difficulty getting permits to do that. So I think we have to be careful not to draw a line and say that working people don't care about taxes and they don't care about regulation, because they do. You ask at the outset, how's a boy in Nebraska do in New York City? I was remarkable man from Governor Woody Williams, who unfortunately died last year. But Woody, South Carolina Marine, was at Iwo Jima, and we were the guest of honors or something for the Veterans Day Parade, the November before COVID, and it was so moving. It was probably 4 miles of solid, people waving flags. I mean, New Yorkers are patriotic.
Yeah, they are.
Liberal Teamsters are patriotic. They don't mind hearing stories about where we've made mistakes in the past, and we've made a lot of them, beginning with slavery. But they don't want to be told it's a terrible country, because they don't believe it. So among the things that we, any public servant, regardless of what they're doing, is trying to, when you say stay in touch, most Americans are patriotic. Most Americans care about their family. Most Americans have some kind of church or religious institution they hang out with, maybe not as often as they should. There's a sort of a common bond with being an American that precedes your political party. And that statement's become cliche, but it's true. And you can't, for anybody in public service, you got to be careful not to let it become cliche.
Well, I agree with that. And I got to tell you that I was also troubled by the fact that the first guy I ever worked for was Jimmy Carter. And I'm a religious guy. I used to be a Sunday school teacher. And it always bothered me during this time was the rise of Jerry Falwell and some of the kind of political evangelists. I don't know how the Democratic Party lost possession of God. You know, it seemed that all of a sudden, if you were a Republican, you were a religious person. But if you were a Democrat, you weren't. And I don't know how that happened. Do you think we've lost that? Do you think we're seen as kind of cynical?
No.
Well, that's good.
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, it. No, we certainly, I think, need to stay tolerant and open-minded of all religious beliefs or non-religious beliefs. Again, this is cliche, but if you're in combat with somebody, you don't start off the battle making certain that they believe in God or that they are Democrats you're just in the fight together. So it's hard to do it today. In some ways, it's harder because social media just is constantly riling you up with things that are being said. I mean, it feels like my dopamine is maxed out 24 hours a day. So it is unquestionably more difficult, but it's not impossible. So no, I do not think Democrats have lost the faith, and I think they understand that, there are intangibles, including belief in God, that carry people through.
Well, and I'd just like to point out to, given what you just said, that remind people that my former boss, Jimmy Carter, is 97 years old, and he's still teaching Sunday school. So we know that there are Democrats out there.
He did a number of things that come to mind. I mean, I was, when he was elected, I was still a Republican. But man, and he got beat up badly by kinds of things. But the longer I live, and the more I pay attention to what he accomplished, I think, my goodness, this guy, he was a remarkable president and remarkable. Nobody's a better former president than him. But it's hands down, he's the best former president we've ever had.
Yeah, he certainly is. And you know, it's funny. I'll tell you a funny anecdote. I went to a reunion maybe 10 years after he left office, and he stood up and he said, "I'm proud of the fact that every major newspaper in America has endorsed me." He said, "Unfortunately, that didn't happen until 1985. So, he really is, right? He's known as a great, great former president. Let me ask you, you were president for 10 years of the New School. Now, if our listeners don't know, the New School is this progressive university in New York City that's based on kind of democratic values. Given the state of America today and young people, do we need more education like this? And should we really be doing this in secondary schools? Should high schools focus more on social teaching social justice, for example? And where's the line between making people aware and indoctrinating people?
Oh, the second part's an easy one. If a young person goes to school and learns something that causes them to come home and disagree with me, they've been indoctrinated. If they come home and agree with me, they've been taught correctly. It could be quite unpleasant.
Exactly.
If they turn right or left, it doesn't really matter. Look, I think we have to be careful not to say that this is the responsibilities of the school. This is one where we as adults got to take this on. Yeah. This is where and it's so easy today to do it. Citizenship is a remarkable thing to acquire, and maybe the best thing that we Americans who were given our citizenship. I mean, my mom did all the work to make me a citizen. She delivered me. That was it. I'm born. I'm a citizen. Every year at the New School, we held a naturalization ceremony, and it's really quite moving. I mean, the naturalized citizens is I would say pound for pound more patriotic than the non-naturalized.
Yeah,
because they know what they've gotten. It's the old adage, you know, if you have to work for something, you tend to value it more than if it's given to you. And go listen to those people after they've been made citizen. They're waving flags of every nation on earth. Ask them about this country. Ask them not only what do they like about it, and they'll give you a very moving answer, but they've had to study. You know, they didn't learn this in high school. They learned it because they had to learn it in order to become a citizen. So I would say it begins with us constantly making the effort to understand our democracy. And this can be hard too, Michael, because you'll discover things. You think, "Oh my God, that was a terrible thing we did." I'm just finished reading a book called "Embers of War," which is about how we ended up in Vietnam with the Vietnam War. And you look at some of these decisions and say, "Oh my God, it's terrible we did this. It's terrible we did that." Well, that's one of the great things about our countries. We can examine our past. We can be critical of our past, and we can try to still make it the country of our dreams. I don't know if you saw that Ken Burns series on the Vietnam War. It's a wonderful story, perhaps the best visual storyteller in the country today. But anyway, he interviewed the guy from North Vietnam who had fought for the Viet Minh, the North Vietnamese, and he said something really important for Americans to remember. He said, you know, I watched the demonstrations against the war that were going on in the United States, and at the time, I thought that that was a sign of weakness. Now, he said, I realize that's a sign of strength. And it is a sign of strength that we can protest our policies, that we can disagree, that we can argue. It's not a sign of weakness that we're having ferocious arguments. It's not a sign of weakness that our disagreements can be expressed publicly without fear of the police coming and haul us away because we're saying something that's at odds with whoever is the leader at the time. So part of the citizenship effort, in my view, the most important part, is adults making the effort, sometimes for the first time, to understand our history, to understand who we are, to understand what's the difference between a democracy and a Republican form of government. I mean, one of the maybe the most important thing in my view about democracy is that this is hard, but the most powerful force in democracy is uninformed public opinion. And it sometimes it's just, the citizen, we become a mob and we do bad things. So I think the burden for helping young people become citizens should fall outside of the school and inside the homes or wherever adults live, where they're making an effort. I'm blabbering on too long. You and I both used the word cynicism a couple of times earlier. And I didn't stop, and I will now, that cynicism is a disease. It's a disease that's born of a belief that human beings are incapable of doing good. Skepticism is really important. It's not a disease at all. It's a healthy attitude that you've got to prove your proposition to me. You think the election was stolen? Show me. You think that the sun gets up in the west? Show me. You present the facts. I've got to be able to evaluate those claims. But cynics have lost their belief that human beings are capable of doing good. And unfortunately, far too often, older people tend to inject that virus into younger people and cause them to believe that it's not worth getting. Why would I want to make an effort to learn about democracy? It's all rigged anyway. It isn't rigged. It's difficult. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, sometimes you're the windshield, and sometimes you're the bug. But, we have the opportunity to make a more perfect union, and you either believe that or you don't.
Well, I think that's so important. I was raised in New Jersey as a young boy, and I know you were raised in Nebraska, and I assume that you and I did the same thing every day when we went to school and we stood up and said the Pledge of Allegiance. Should we bring that back into schools, do you think? Should kids be saying the Pledge of Allegiance?
I didn't become a patriotic person as a result of saying the Pledge of Allegiance. I think you have to. I don't think that's what gets the job done. I think again, it's adults. We've got to grasp this idea that we have freedom, and we have freedom to decide how we're going to make our country or how we're going to make it better. And again, it can be difficult. Let me just take one. In order to be able to say, I live in a country where everybody has health insurance, everybody can afford to go to school, everybody can afford to take care of their parents, people like me who make, more money are going to have to probably pay higher taxes in order to get that done. It's going to necessitate redistributing income from one group of people to another. That provokes a ferocious argument. You might even provoke an argument with me in those instances where the money isn't being well used by the government in the first place. So I'm just saying these ideas that we have about how to make our country better, they're not as easy as saying the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm not persuaded that that Pledge of Allegiance is either good or bad. You say to my kids going to a school where they have to do the Pledge of Allegiance, don't you think that's terrible? I say, no, I don't think it's terrible. You said to me, they're going to a school where they don't do the Pledge of Allegiance, do you think that's terrible? I say, no, I don't think that's terrible at all. It's a decision that gets made at the local level. And if I was down there at the local level arguing at a school board, I'd probably argue against it. but I tried to be sufficiently respectful to the people who are proposing it that they believe that it would prove the number of people who are patriotic. If you'd have asked me a year ago, how do I feel about mandatory military service, I'd have been negative. I'm not negative any longer. Whether it's 6 months or 1 year, that military experience makes you understand that you're living in something that's bigger than just your own life. It's expensive. It's not easy to do. I understand, but my goodness. It should not be run by not-for-profits. It should be the military. They know how to organize things like this, set a goal. I mean, there was a guy by the name of Kulak who was the chief of the Commandant of the Marine Corps in the 1990s, and he believed and he demonstrated that he could organize a program for the Marine Corps that when they were done with the Marine Corps, their characters improved. They had better character. Obviously, going to be patriotic as well. So I could get a lot more excited about that than I could about mandating people do a Pledge of Allegiance every day.
Well, I got to tell you, I told you before the show, I come from a military family, and I'm proud to say that I've gotten several awards from veterans organizations for my work with military families. And I couldn't agree with you more. When you meet veterans, they really are an amazing group of people. They're beyond being patriotic. They're motivated and focused, and they really are amazing. So I don't disagree with you. Maybe we should have mandatory military service. Let me ask you. Let's talk about the National Resources Defense Council for a minute. This is a group I'm familiar with as well. Are we doing enough to combat climate change? Is there more that Congress can do? It seems to me, I took an environmental science course when I was in college 100 years ago, and everything that they said about global warming in the 1970s when I was in college seems to be coming true to me today. More storms, more violent storms, more frequency. It seems that we're moving in exactly the same direction in the direction that environmentalists said we would move in. Is Congress doing enough, you think, to combat global warming and global climate change?
Well, I think the answer is no, but this Congress and this president have done more than any other administration or Congress previously. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act may be poorly named, but it will be remembered, as well as some of the direct spending that's done by particularly the Department of Energy, authorized and appropriated by the Congress and signed by the president in law. This will be seen as a turning point. And I hope that week from Tuesday, that American people recognize that and keep those who support this. And at the moment, it's only Democrats. It's unfortunate because There was a time back in the 90s, on an issue like this, you'd get John Chafee, you'd get Warren Rudman, you'd get Alan Simpson, you'd get Jack Danforth, you'd get Republicans, all that I just mentioned. We'd say, this is a problem. We've got to do something about it. I mean, the Environmental Protection Agency was created, signed into law by Richard Nixon, as the Endangered Species Act, right, the Clean Water Act. Are they doing enough? I would say no, but are they doing more than it's ever been done in the past? Do we need to reward them for doing so? Do we need to believe that it's important? I'm emphatically in that corner, and I think I hope the Democrats hold the majority in the House and the Senate, but among the things that will be remembered if they don't is that we missed the opportunity again. I do think climate's on the ballot. I think minimum wage is on the ballot. I think health insurance for working families is on the number of things that are on the ballot. It's inflation is a problem, borders a problem, immigration is a concern of mine, but the thing that I said earlier that really worries me is statutes that are creating inequality. And the legislation that they passed, I think it will also demonstrate that it's a false choice to say I have to choose between jobs and the environment. It's a false choice. The promotion of green energy that has just been put into effect by a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president make that case loud and clear. I hope, to repeat myself, that it's sufficiently persuasive that they hold the majority.
Yeah, I hope so too. Look slim in the House and better in the Senate, but yes, I hope so too. And back to what you said prior, I'm a patriot because I was, as I mentioned to you, an orphan who was a high school dropout who now has a master's degree, you know, got a master's degree, started my own company, and, you know, got elected to public office. And I think to myself, this is the only country in the world that would happen. I hope you're absolutely right. Let me ask you, though, is if we're headed towards a rematch between Biden and Trump, what can we do as Democrats to secure our future? I mean, the reelection of Donald Trump would just be horrible, in my opinion.
Well, I think what we have to do is to talk to people who aren't persuaded of that conclusion. You're not going to persuade all of them, but I think if you calmly and rationally make a case for Biden and what he's gotten done, at a minimum, you've got a decent human being that treats people with respect. But at a maximum, there's a lot that's been accomplished. Some disappointments, some things that he hasn't been able to get done, some things that he wanted to get done that I didn't necessarily support. But the improvement in our country, 10 million jobs, for goodness sake, in the last 2 years. I think there's plenty there. But I think you have to calmly and respectfully talk to people as if they're your twin brother and they just happen to reach a different conclusion than you have. You can't start off saying you're stupid and you're a moron and you're deplorable and you don't understand what the hell's going on.
Right.
I've got all the truth and you just said, you know, you're not going to persuade anybody with that kind of language.
So have we made a big mistake here, which I think we have, in putting all our eggs into the abortion basket, to what happened with the Supreme Court decision? When we look at polls nationally, we see that abortion is not at the top of the list for either Democrats or Republicans. Should we have been talking more about the economy and more about the accomplishments and more than we are talking about a woman's right to choose, even though many of us, men and women, believe that this is a really important issue that speaks to the domination of women more than it speaks to the right to life?
Oh, there's no question that you just said is 100% right. I mean, this is going back. You take away a fundamental freedom from 50% of the population. By the way, while Mexico is going in the opposite direction, that's all I need to know. If you examine Roe v. Wade, there's lots of restrictions. I would enthusiastically support, some kind of federal legislation that provided women with a substantial amount of protection, maybe less protection than is currently there in the third trimester. I don't know. It really is a step backward. If I had a daughter right now who was going to a school in a state that was making abortion illegal, I'm not sure I'd let her go. Not sure I'd have any control over her. She's probably as independent as I am, and she'd tell me to go buzz off. But it's a significant step backwards. But it's also connected to something that I think Democrats have missed, which is this court, I mean, the Federal Society have used Trump to get what they want, which is an activist court. It uses the 14th Amendment to protect the freedom and liberty of corporations. That's not an exaggeration. But maybe it's hard to do this you know, separating Roe from the other things they're going to do, they're going to make it very difficult for Congress to pass legislation that restricts what corporations are doing. They're going to use the due process portion of the 14th Amendment to say corporations are human beings. We already saw it with Citizens United, and I think post-election, that's going to be the big story. I'll bet there's a, you know, I don't know, $200-$250 million of so-called independent spending that will have occurred from Labor Day through the 8th of November, thanks to Citizens United saying corporations are individuals and you can't restrict their freedom of speech. That's all of the piece. So in some ways, the larger problem, not in some ways, in a big way, the larger problem with this court, and I love the court. I love going down and watching and listening to their arguments, but they're going to strengthen the freedom and liberty of corporations against individuals, whether they're women or black or labor or whoever they are. You're going to have a lot less power as a consequence of this court.
Well, it's an amazing thing to watch, isn't it, from a party that's constantly speaking out against activists, judges. You know, the court is supposed to be
bingo. No. Well, right. And by the way, this is another controversial thing, I suppose, to say, but part of the problem that we Democrats have is we fell in love with the Warren Court, and they were very activist, overturning state legislation, yeah, overturning city councils. We loved activism when it was in our favor. We don't necessarily like it when it's not. And my own view is, very famous and important jurist, Felix Frankfurter, who was very liberal before FDR appointed the court, but lots of liberals thought he sold out because he believed passionately in judicial restraint, as do I. You may not like what the city council has done or the county board has done or the state legislature or the Congress itself, unless it's a clear violation of civil rights, setting up 1964 civil rights, 1965 voting rights, even 1968 fair housing. Unless it's a clear violation of our Constitution, I don't think we want to strike at it. We don't want a court who has not been elected making legislative decisions. And we're going to see that. In some ways, we got ourselves to blame. We like what the Warren Court was doing. And now all of a sudden, we don't like what the Roberts Court was doing when they're responding to their, you know, the groups that support them with judicial activism.
Well, are you surprised by the Republicans, especially Republicans in the Senate, who have come up and supported things like the election deniers and are standing behind people like the Heisman Trophy winner from Georgia, and Marjorie Taylor Greene? Does that surprise you? I know the second thing I learned at the DNC was that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. Does it surprise you that all these people are lining up behind these really incredible candidates? Look, the one nice thing about Trump, the one positive thing that's come out of the Trump election for me is that none of my family ever asked for my political opinion. Because before, in 2016, I said, there's no way that people can vote for this man. There's no way this man can get elected. I said, I've been in politics 40 years. Take my advice. There's no way this guy's going to get elected. Now they don't ask me anymore. But does it surprise you how many of these people in Congress that knew, you were there, you know that they knew that the election wasn't rigged, but they stood up there and told that lie to support their part?
Well, I'm not surprised. And, I disagree with it. And you've mentioned a couple people that I have strong disagreements with. But you don't have to look back very far to find where things were worse. We had some real scoundrels in the Congress in the 1930s. So I don't have to go back very far to find it. And the problem is that I'm sitting here tempted to trash Herschel Walker and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And that's counterproductive in my view. I'm having served in the Senate and having served as governor and been involved in politics in a number of ways, I feel duty-bound to say to people, you're going to find scoundrels in the Congress. But most people in that Congress, Republican and Democrat, are not scoundrels. And they're doing the best they can under very difficult circumstances to try to figure out what the right answer is. So I have to resist the temptation to be negative, because I'm not surprised. It has been worse, and it's up to us to encourage people to become candidates, encourage people to try to figure out how to make things better, and not take the, what I consider to be, self-destructive bait.
Well, and you're right. You know, we have a very short political memory, don't we? People forget about people like Eugene McCarthy and some of the I grew up in North New Jersey, which was a segregated city, and I think every mayor we elected, five mayors in a row, all went to jail. So,
if your listeners are looking for a good read to make the point that you and I are both making right now, I forget the name of it. I'll think of it in 30 minutes when I'm going to bed. But it's a book about the confirmation of Thurgood Marshall in 1967, I believe, is when it may have, 67 or 68. And the opposition to Thurgood Marshall and the language that's being used, you know, by people that I respect, and what they were doing is responding, in my opinion, is that they had a large fraction of white voters who held very racist views of Thurgood Marshall, and they didn't want him on the Supreme Court. Had nothing to do with anything that he had done. Had nothing to do with his intelligence. It had to do with one thing, racism. So they're sitting there saying, maybe they believed it. I think it's unlikely that they did, but they talked themselves into political positions that, upon reflection, certainly looking back on it, you can't make the case that they were right. So I said it once before: public opinion, uninformed public opinion, is a powerful force, and I don't, and so this one, to my mind, begins with a former president saying, I'm not going to concede the election. Worse, I'm going to say it was rigged. Worse, I'm going to say it was, I'm encouraging people to believe QAnon stories about, sex rings in a pizza parlor in Washington. I mean, I'll just buy into all of it. And it destroys public confidence in democracy.
Yeah, it's amazing, and the pizza gate thing that you just mentioned. My first assistant was a part-time bartender there. It's where I had both my victory parties, election night victory parties. We were all amazed by that. We were amazed, not only amazed by the lie, but amazed by how long the lie persisted. And it still persists.
Right.
We still see it.
Right.
We still see it out there, and it's just absolutely crazy. Let me ask you one last question. We're running out of time here. First of all, is there anything you want to say that I haven't asked you? I'd like to know what you're doing today. What are you doing today?
Well, right at this moment, I am in London, England. A 21-year-old who's a junior in college, and he's taken a study abroad program. So it is 11:50 here.
But I know. My God work bless life you back, for doing this.
My work life is I'm a managing director at a little merchant bank in New York City called Allen & Company. It's been a great experience for me. It's a family private business, and it's given me an opportunity to work with really smart, talented, excited young people that have great ideas. And, so I get to do that. Now I do a couple of not-for-profits. The biggest one is I'm still working on trying to make peace with Vietnam. We're building their educational capacity through the Fulbright University Vietnam program in Ho Chi Minh City. So those two things and a couple of others besides is what I'm doing right now.
Well, that's really important work. I'm certainly of that generation and remember how the war tore our country apart, and some of the unfortunate externalities of the war that we tended as a country to hold it against the soldiers rather than the government. You know, it's like I don't know how that happened. Even as a guy that protested on the mall more than once against the war because I was 18 at the time and didn't believe in it, I never once lost my respect for all my friends that stood up for the country and went over there and fought. So I think that's really important work.
Have you seen the movie The Best Beer Run?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I'm Chuck Hagel and I are hosting. We're calling it the world premiere, but it's not really the world premiere. It's called The Greatest Beer Run Ever. Billy Murray's in, and it's really a terrific cast. But the whole story is a true story. Some guys in Boston in 1972 watching protesters, and they said, gee, our buddies in Vietnam, they think that this is, that we don't care for them. So they did a beer run to, four or five guys that were in country and during the war and took them a beer.
Wow.
So,
well, I'll have to watch that. And I want to tell you that moved to the very top of my reading list is When I Was a Young Man, the book you wrote, the memoir. I really want to read that. I'm sure there's a lot of great insights in there. And again,
I strongly recommend reading that book in those moments when you're not able to get to sleep.
Oh, come on. I can't believe that. You're a fascinating conversationalist, and I'm sure you're a great writer. And look, we're running out of time, so we're about to leave. And let me thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome.
And say to my listeners that, every week we choose a song at the end of the show to play us out, and we dedicate it to our guests. And today was one of the easiest choices I ever had to make. So we'll see you next week, folks. Here's Mariah Carey with Hero. Thank you so much for being on the show, Bob Carey, because you certainly are one of my heroes.
Thanks, Senator.
Give the people their right to vote.